From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
This morning, we speak with Josh Fishman. He's a senior editor at Scientific American. In this month's issue, the magazine has published a guide to novel versions of the COVID-causing virus and genetic changes that can make them more contagious and evasive in the body. The discussion is surrounding the most worrying mutations in five emerging coronavirus variants. Josh Fishman, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you back.
It's really good to be back.
Can we start with this? What's the difference between a variant and a mutation?
Good question. And the answer is fortunately pretty simple. A variant is the version of the virus that differs from the original normal version. The mutation is the change in the genetic material in the virus that makes it different.
Okay. Initially, when the coronavirus was first identified, there was the belief that it was quite stable and it wasn't going to mutate. It went along like that for, about 6 or 8 months, and then suddenly there was a mutation. So what is the science behind that, and why was the initial belief that it was stable, and then now it's not as stable as once thought?
Right, yeah, when kind of amazing to think that we've been now living with this virus for a year in the United States, longer in other parts of the world like China. When it first started infecting people, scientists had sequenced a bunch of the versions of the virus that infected a bunch of people. And they matched up the genetic sequences of them and saw that they were all pretty similar. So that gave them the sense that the virus really wasn't evolving or changing all that much. And evolution and change is how viruses acquire mutations, and enough mutations make the virus different enough that we would call it a variant. Then what happened was, sadly, the virus became extremely successful, and that's why we have a worldwide pandemic and why we have this tragic number of dead people all around the planet. And the virus is in so many people that each infected person is a different chance for the virus to evolve. Some of those chances will randomly result in a mutation that turns out to make the virus more effective.
Let me just go over a couple of assumptions that I have. We'll call it vaccine 101. And I just want to make sure I have this. And this will help me understand the mutation variant side. First assumption is that I get COVID, and COVID on the COVID virus is something called a spike protein. And there might be multiple spike proteins. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly what goes on, John.
Okay. And then the spike protein is what binds to the human receptor, and that's how it gets into us and actually infects us. Is that correct?
That's what the nasty little bugger does, yes.
Okay. And then the final assumption is the viral spike protein is what is targeted by our vaccine.
Yes.
Does the vaccine decouple the spike protein from the receptor? Does it turn it off? Does it kill the spike protein?
That's a good question, John. And what all the vaccines to date do, and keep in mind that there are several of them, what they all have in common is they target this spike receptor, which, as you noted, is the way that the virus attaches to human cells. And what they do is they get the body, your own body, to generate antibodies, which are little proteins. And the antibodies stick to the end of that spike protein that would normally attach to a human cell. And by sticking to it, they create a blockage so the spike protein can't attach to its normal site on the human cell. It's a key and lock situation. The spike is normally a key that fits nicely into a lock on that human cell.
Okay.
But these antibodies act like little pieces of chewing gum on the end of your key and prevent the key from sliding smoothly into the lock.
Okay. So just a final question. So what we're talking about this morning is the spike protein or receptor will modify itself. It will mutate so that the efficacy of the vaccine may be less, but it's so far it's not showing us it's going to be greatly less. So if it was a Pfizer that was 90% efficacy, it now may be just a little bit less because that spike protein is a slightly different version. Is that correct also?
That's almost correct. Okay. There's one vaccine in a small trial, the vaccine made by Novavax, which was by luck or accident tried in South Africa, where one of these variants has become the dominant strain. And in that small trial, it looked like that particular vaccine didn't do that well. It had just about 50% effectiveness against blocking all cases of COVID. It was, however, and this is the good news part, about 80 to 90% effective at blocking severe cases of COVID. That's the stuff that will land you in the hospital, as opposed to the kind of case that keeps you on the couch feeling like you have the flu for a week. So that's good news. We really want these vaccines to keep people from getting really sick. Getting mildly sick, that's not fun, but we can deal with it.
Okay, perfect, thank you.
If you're just joining us, excuse me. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Josh Fishman. He's senior editor at Scientific American. We're speaking about the variants of COVID-19 virus and how the efficacy of these vaccines will sort of go forward. And Josh, I'm wondering, with these five main variants around the world, and I'm going to try to list where they all were. I think we saw the first one in the UK, and then there's Spain and South Africa and Brazil, and I'm missing one.
No, you got them. There are two in Brazil.
Oh, two in Brazil. Okay. And, around the world, literally billions have been spent on developing these vaccines. And what are the companies doing now? How do they address the variants? And how long does it take to update a vaccine?
That's a good question. And the companies have already started, and some of them have announced that they could have a preparation vaccine ready to test in a month or so, and then they're going to have to run a small trial to make sure that it's effective, and that'll have to last maybe another month. So I think that, conservatively speaking, we're looking at the beginning of April before we have really good data, really good information about whether these vaccines work.
Okay, so in the meantime, it's just business as usual. I feel like we're still in the infancy of really establishing channels of vaccination within states and counties and even municipalities. I don't know, it's just kind of crazy. Like this week in our county, in Summit County, we have some really promising news in terms of numbers going way down of new cases and more people, we're able to get all of the vaccines shipped to us, administered. We're not wasting a single dose. But as these variants pop up, is there indication that there will be more and more variants mutating from the initial variant? What does that mean for really keeping up with it?
Well, it means that we're kind of in a race with the virus. That as more people get infected, the simple numbers are that more people infected give more chance for the virus to mutate and more chance for those mutations to create a variant that is of concern that might escape the most effectiveness of the vaccines. So the most effective way that we can deal with that is twofold. One, practice good public health, which really boils down to wear a mask, stay socially distanced, stay out of large gatherings. And that will keep the virus from jumping from person to person the way it has been. And we have good evidence that those measures work. And you're seeing that in Summit County. And number two is to get more vaccine shots into more arms as quickly as we can. And as you also noted in Summit County, and maybe I should move there, that's happening. You know, every week we are getting more vaccines into more arms, and sounds like Summit County is doing a really good job of that. And the more people that get the shot, the harder it will be for the virus to jump from person to person and find new vessels to develop these dangerous mutations.
Josh, you know what I find fascinating is that, you know, I've always assumed that if there's something in Brazil and all of a sudden it shows up in the United States, it was because somebody got on an airplane and they came to our country. Now, that may be true, but also it's possible that the virus in the United States mutated in the same way as the virus in Brazil, as an example. You have this variant called uppercase N 501 uppercase Y. And this is a variant that seems to show up around the world. It's interesting, as you mentioned earlier, that each individual person could develop its own version of the virus. But these prominent versions that have the same variant, that's just fascinating that they'll have the same variant in different locations. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure can, John. And what that indicates is that that mutation, that 501 mutation that you mentioned, is actually doing something to help the virus survive. What we think that something is it's helping the virus to evade the natural antibodies that your immune system produces. Mm-hmm. So that variant is at the part of the spike protein that binds, it's called the receptor binding domain. It's the part that sticks onto the human cell. It's also the part that is targeted by the antibodies that your immune system creates. And what they do is they stick to that area on the spike protein and neutralize it. That's actually the term that scientists use. So if 501 makes the surface of the spike protein a little bit different, the antibodies that you produce have trouble hanging on to it and neutralizing it. And that makes it easier for the virus to attach to and infect the human cell. And so apparently that's a event that the virus in several different countries has gone through. It's encountered antibodies that give it trouble, and just through natural random change, it's hit on this mutation 501 that makes it more slippery for the antibodies, and therefore that mutation has become dominant, and the virus with it is more successful. And that's happened in several different countries.
Yes. Josh, that's a great explanation. What's the relationship between genes and this virus?
Well, this virus is... Viruses are weird things. You know, they're not really alive. They're not really dead. They're basically a little strip of genetic material surrounded by a little bit of protein. Mm-hmm. And this virus, the coronavirus, is a little strip of RNA, and which is short for ribonucleic acid. But RNA is a lot easier to say, so let's just keep calling it that. And it's surrounded by a shell, protein shell, with more proteins that stud out of it that look like thorns or spikes. And we've been talking a lot about the spike protein. And that's actually why it's called a coronavirus, because of this crown of spikes that surrounds it. Crown being corona.
And back to the gene. Lynn, just a quick one. If two genes go into the same cell, they can commingle during replication. Like a viral sex, I guess. I don't know, but does that help produce a mutation, a unique mutation?
Yeah, that can in certain viruses. In the flu virus, for example, which is not this virus, but it's the influenza virus, their genome, their strip of genetic material at their heart, it is kind of segmented. And inside of your cell, it can break apart and then recombine if two different viruses infect the same cell, which they can do, or the same body. So that's why we have a whole different variety of strains of flu that circulate at the same time. And it doesn't really happen, that kind of recombination. It does not really happen with the coronavirus that we've all been worried about. It has a more robust genome, more robust strip of RNA. So these mutations seem to be arising spontaneously.
Josh, I'm wondering, in the article, there's some discussion about how, you know, even as we see these variants, of course, the vaccine produces so many antibodies that there will still be some effectiveness. And as you've talked about already, will sort of maybe if it doesn't neutralize the virus, indeed, it will make it less severe. And then it also talks about the vaccines stimulating other protective components of the immune system. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
It's a good time to mention that the development of these vaccines is really, to me, remarkable. It's just an amazing testament to the power of basic science that within 10 months of first detecting this virus and being able to do a genetic sequence of it, we actually have effective vaccines out there in the public getting shots into people's arms. The previous record for producing a vaccine was 4 years, and before that it was decades. So it's just a real testimony to the years of basic science that went into figuring out how to do a vaccine that could produce a big immune response and do it quickly once you understood what the virus looked like genetically. And so what the first two vaccine makers that rolled out vaccines, Moderna and Pfizer, did was figure out a shot that not just produced antibodies, these little bits of chewing gum that I described that stick on the end of the spike, but the shot stimulates a bunch of cells in your immune system that respond to outside infections. Some of those cells are memory cells called T cells. And what they do is they hold memories of the irritant protein, let's say the spike protein, that is a foreign object in your body. And they sound an alarm through your immune system to go ahead and start the antibody factories up against this foreign object. Those antibody factories are yet other cells called B cells. And they're the ones that produce the antibodies against the spike protein. And it's important to be able to ramp up a lot of these factories very quickly when you've got an infection, because the more factories you have, the more antibodies you can produce, and the faster you can neutralize the virus. So the vaccine hits all three of those parts of the immune system, the antibodies themselves, the B cells, and the two types of T cells. And what it does is it gets them all kind of up in arms and working to try and produce ways of attacking the virus. Some of the cells will actually go and attack infected cells that are filled with the virus and try and destroy them. So there are lots of ways your body can go after this virus. And I was just reading a paper that shows that this memory, this immune system memory that I was talking about, lasts for at least 8 months, which is, again, good news.
Good news. Josh, when I listen to you speak, I think you sound much more like a scientist than you do a journalist. And it's really fascinating to me, the work that you do Scientific American.
I am so not a scientist.
But, you know, and one of your jobs, of course, as a journalist, is to help bring the science to the masses and come up with these little, figurative stories and metaphors to help us. When you talk about bubble gum, for example, it really does help us understand. What is the direction at Scientific American? You have covered COVID so robustly over the last year. What are the next emerging topics, do you think, surrounding COVID?
Obviously, we're very interested in the getting shots in the arms stage right now, you know, just like you are. And I think that, you know, when you ask what we're interested in the magazine, the real answer is we're interested in what you're interested in. You know, we are the same people that you are, and we want to be able to answer the questions that you have. And as these vaccines have become available to the public, we want to know how well they're working, and we want to know how hard it's been to get them out and into people's arms. The early rollout, you know, starting just before Christmas up to now, has been frustrating and disappointing. I don't know how the experience of you and your neighbors has been, but where I live in Maryland, we have not had the amount of vaccines delivered that we thought we would have. And it's been difficult to figure out the different rules that the state and the local county has for priority groups, because they're slightly different. And the state and the county are running different clinics and allowing different private entities like drugstores to deliver the vaccine. So it's been hard to make appointments to find shots. So we're very interested in how you sign up and actually get a shot, and whether those shots are going into the priority groups that should be getting them. I'm personally very interested in finding out whether it's harder for people who don't have computers and who don't have cars to be able to get to these vaccine clinics, because the early rollouts of these vaccines have depended upon signing up online and sometimes having to drive to a place that isn't on mass transportation. So that means that people who don't have internet are going to have more trouble. So I want to know what cities and towns and states are doing to resolve that problem and make sure that people aren't penalized simply because they have a poor internet connection or they can't afford a computer.
Josh, I wanted to ask you about something of the South African virus, and that is in the article you talk about Jesse Bloom, who in his lab created a series of spike proteins with almost all of the 3,800 possible protein component changes that could be driven by a genetic mutation. In other words, they tried to understand what all the different possibilities were. And then they tested how well or poorly they did to, I guess, the efficacy of the virus itself, and found that there was one mutation that made it 10 times more difficult for antibodies to bind to the spike in some people. And that particular mutation has actually shown up in South Africa. So I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but is it possible, or are you suggesting that there's some sort of viral intelligence that can ascertain what the Achilles heel is of the humans? In other words, what would increase or maximize the lethality, if that's a word, its ability to be lethal? Is that what you're saying here?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Except if you view intelligence as this kind of very passive numbers game, because that's really what I'm talking about.
Okay.
That South African mutation, which has also shown up in Brazil. Mm-hmm. The name of the mutation is another mouthful, because scientists like to talk in mouthfuls, and this one is called E484K.
Yes.
But scientists are beginning to talk about it, describe it as EEK, which is a little bit easier, though not exactly scientific, but I'll go with that. So imagine this, that when you're infected with a virus, there are millions upon millions of virus particles in your body. When millions of people are affected by the virus, there are, I'm not a math whiz, but millions of millions times millions times millions times millions. So every one of those virus particles is a chance, you know, a coin flip for a virus to develop a mutation when it replicates. So chances are that among those millions, the virus is going to hit on something that is EEK or is very close to EEK. And because EEK happens to evade the antibodies that your body is producing against the virus, that particular virus with the EEK mutation is going to escape the antibodies, survive, go on to infect another cell, and replicate. And when it replicates, all of its replicants are also going to carry EEK. And they're also going to be successful. So they are going to go on and infect other cells, and it's off to the races. It's not so much of intelligence as a really big game of numbers. Does that make sense?
I think it does. I mean, it could have mutated to a much less lethal version, but the E484K, I mean, it's making it, as it says in the paper here, 10 times more difficult to bind to spike in some people. So that's where I got the intelligence part. And that was a bit of a leap for sure. But the numbers thing does make sense to me.
Yeah, it's kind of like you remember Darwin's finches in the Galapagos?
Yeah.
That, you know, they had a variety of beak shapes that were well suited to the different kind of nuts available on the different islands. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't go out and say, well, I'm going to develop a really strong beak because I've got really big nuts on this island, and somebody else is going to develop a slender beak to, you know, go after a different shaped nuts on a different island. Right. It was simply that the finches would randomly develop, some finches would randomly develop a big beak, and those finches, since they had a big beak, would be able to crack more nuts. And they ate better, survived more, laid more eggs, and The birds that came out of those eggs also had big beaks. And so that became the dominant feature. That's exactly what's going on with EEK.
Okay, so the E484K EEK is a more efficient virus, and I understand it shows up more often, and because it shows up more often, it goes into that mathematical thing that you were talking about, where it's going to that version is going to replicate much faster than the other versions. Thank you.
Yes, it's just going to unfortunately find more fertile ground.
Yes, that does make sense. Thank you.
What is the public's job here? And then we'll let you go.
Well, our job is to wear the dang mask. The CDC has come out with actual data in the past 2 weeks showing states with more people wearing masks have lower hospitalizations than states that have fewer people wearing masks. So that's evidence that masks work. And two, this week, the CDC has come out with a lab study showing that if you double mask, it's about 90 to 95% effective at stopping the flow of virus particles from one person to another. So if both people double mask, and by double mask, I mean wearing one of those sort of flimsy paper masks mm-hmm. that your dentist wears, as well as one of the cool cloth masks that you've probably made yourself or bought. You know, if you put them both on, and if everybody puts them both on, it's really effective at stopping transmission of the virus from person to person. But everybody has to do it. It can't just be one person wears a mask and the next person doesn't. So that's a big thing that we have to do. The other big thing that we should do is figure out a way of registering to get a vaccine. When you get an appointment, show up and get the shot. The shots are really effective. And the cool thing about these shots is that because the vaccine is based on the actual sequence, the genetic sequence that the virus uses to produce that spike protein, vaccine makers have found that it's pretty easy to adjust that sequence in their factories and make one with one of these mutations, like the 501 mutation that we were talking about earlier, or the EEK mutation. They can adjust the shots and make them effective against these new variants.
Well, it's really promising. Josh Fishman, senior editor at Scientific American, it's great to have you back on Cool Science Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Lynn, and thank you, John. These are great questions. I'd love to come back anytime.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.